Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Cindy F. Solomon coming to you today with the Global Product Management Talk. I'm coming to you on August 6th from the San Francisco Bay Area. I'm delighted to be here today. We're talking about managing the product end of life, whether you should kill a product or retire gracefully. Our speaker today is John Newbery, who is coming to us from the United Kingdom. And our co-host today is Greg Gerrich, who is joining us from San Diego. The Global Product Management Talk is curated for professional product people who are passionate about teaching, learning, and networking, about everything that it takes to produce successful products. We come to you in an open digital environment. We invite live participation. Everyone is invited to join us on Twitter and through Blog Talk Radio, including agile practitioners, user experience people, designers, content and community managers, product marketing, brand management, program managers, customer service, everyone, and all those involved with developing, designing, and launching products, innovation and startups throughout the entire product lifecycle process to guarantee successful products and companies. We are available weekly. You can listen to us on iTunes, on Blog Talk Radio, at blogtalkradio.com/PRODMGMTTALK. Use the hashtag PRODMGMTTALK to follow us and participate with us on Twitter. I want to thank this week's sponsor, the AIPMM, the Association of International Product Marketing and Management, which was founded in 1998 to promote worldwide excellence in product management education by providing value to individual members, corporate members, and sponsors through training, education, certification, and professional networking opportunity. The AIPMM 7-Phase Product Lifecycle Framework is a vendor-independent product management and product marketing standard. The ProdBot is the AIPMM product body of knowledge that was developed with input from over 50 experts and endorsed by more than half a dozen consulting companies. It includes 7 distinct product phases from conceived to end of life and covers all aspects of the product management process during the entire product lifecycle. Please visit our sponsor, the AIPMM, at AIPMM.com to find out about ProdBot and upcoming webinars, and subscribe to receive the AIPMM News and Views email newsletter, which now includes not only upcoming webinars, but also upcoming global product management talks. And please visit www.prodmgmttalk.com to find out how you can join us and sponsor us to improve our audio quality and improve ability to bring this information to the global audience. So today we are talking about managing product end of life. And John Newbery, who is a B2B marketing professional, will lead us in discussing the end of the product lifecycle, how to deal with product obsolescence in the retired stage. Many businesses fail to realize that releasing a new product is often easier than retiring an old one. While major organizational resources are spent in the product development and release cycles, many times product retirement becomes an expensive afterthought. This discussion is intended to investigate the very back end of the product lifecycle, product obsolescence, if you will. This vital but frequently overlooked stage of the PLC plays a hugely significant role in the product portfolio. Managed well, it can re-energize your portfolio, support the innovation process, and improve levels of customer loyalty. Managed badly, which we have all seen, or worse, not at all, it can be damaging and expensive to the organization and its customers. I'd like to introduce our speaker, John Newbery, who is coming to us from the UK. He is a B2B marketing professional who is passionate about new technologies, innovative products, and creative thinking. He brings 12 years of experience working for leading international organizations and a full and varied life in the world of B2B marketing. His roles have included product management, marketing strategy, brand strategy, new product development and commercialization, customer relations management, business development, and channel management, all with a focus on measured contribution to top and bottom line performance. And our co-host today is Greg Garich, who is the author of Build It Like a Startup, Product Management-Centered Agile and Lean Innovation, and the Relentless Pursuit of Ideal Product Leadership. Greg is an expert in creating teams to execute complex strategies using collaboration and participative methods. Welcome, John and Greg. Thank you for being with us today.
Hi, Cindy. It's great to be here.
Okay. What brings you to thinking about this and what your experience has been with products? And again, welcome our co-host to jump in as well.
Okay, Cindy, thanks very much. It's great to be here on Product Management Talk. Congratulations to you with the great numbers you're getting on listeners for the show week after week. I think it's really a great platform for product managers all over the world. So really is a pleasure to be here. Another point I think it's really important for me to make up front is that I'm not from the software industry. I'm not even from the tech industry. It always amazes me that from the dirty world of manufacturing for the construction industry, in fact, totally different in terms of the markets we serve, but the similarities for product management really are massive. Yeah, there's so much that we have in common across the challenges we face, the approaches that we take. Despite the differences, there's massive commonality there. I think there's also some big differences, and I think maybe over the next 60 minutes, we'll find out what some of those are. We're going to talk about the product life cycle. I think every product manager will have come across the term. I don't think there's any need to explain in any detail what's involved. But the idea today is to take a look at the back end of the product life cycle. And I think that's an area that we can so easily overlook. And I think it's a shame, because I do think that there's massive potential for innovation, innovative thinking, and revenue and benefit to the business, for companies that are willing to really dig deep and take control of that tail end of the cycle. We're all very familiar with the new product introduction process, the development stages, and pushing the new product from launch up that steep. It sometimes feels really steep from launch up to market penetration and through to maturity. Then it kind of peters out a little bit, I think, for a lot of us. From a product management perspective, we can hand over to the sales teams. You reach that point of maturity where the technical issues have been resolved, the customer base is familiar with the product, the buy-in process has happened, you've started to build a number of advocates out in the marketplace. So you have the loyalty, you have the engagement, all of the important things which a product needs to survive. And then, along comes the next one. And as product managers, we turn and look and start working on the next launch and the next development. And there's always a string of those coming. And that forces us, in a lot of ways, to take our eyes off the ball further down the life cycle. And I think maybe that's starts to touch on the root cause of product obsolescence, and why it is such a challenge for so many of us, and how it ends up being neglected all too often.
Thank you, John. I just want to underline that, because I'm so software-focused here in San Francisco, and particularly in startups, that I forget that there's other types of products. And I know that product lifecycle management works across all industry, and it's essential across all industries. So I'm delighted that you find value weekly. John is a regular participant and a recent co-host as well. So it proves the point that product management crosses all industries, regardless of what the actual product is. There is a shared orientation, shared challenges as well. So thank you for that. Greg, do you have a perspective on that?
Yes, I would wholeheartedly agree with the interest level and the kind of sexiness level of the beginning of the life cycle of a product versus the end of the life cycle. I mean, can you imagine putting an ad in the paper and trying to get quality product managers to kind of manage the when it's become a commodity and kind of the end of life versus a new exciting startup product that we're going to build and it's going to change the world?
Yeah, that's certainly not a job I'd be applying for, Greg. It's the obsolescence stage of the life cycle doesn't have the same sort of attractiveness as the glamorous world of product launches. That's without a doubt.
Great. The one that we had listed is, how does managing product withdrawal differ from managing a product launch?
I started with the big questions, I guess. I was thinking over the weekend of any kind of possible similarity or analogy, and not my most inspired thought, but the one I came up with was thinking about getting up in the morning. A lot of us will go out for a walk or a jog or get on a train to commute to work. We'll pick up the iPod or similar MP3 player, and it may just be me, I hope not, but quite often my earphones are sat next to my iPod and they're bunched up, they're scrunched up, the cable is in an absolute tangled mess, and it can take me anything from 2 to 5 minutes to untangle the cable, get it plugged in, and I'm on my way. I don't know what resonated with me there, but yeah, that really does feel a little bit like withdrawing a product from the range. I think Steve Johnson, in fact, describes the whole process as unlaunching, doing all of the same things as a product launch, just doing them in reverse order. You take out the launch plan that you started off with all those months or even years ago and working backwards. And that certainly helps me to put it into some kind of context as to what we're actually trying to do. And it also, I think, is important because that very point reinforces the fact that, yeah, to unlaunch a product really takes the same or similar kind of resource and time and planning and strategy that you would put into a new product launch. You know, we have no problems at all in our organization forming a launch team. We'll take individuals from across various departments put together to launch a product. Very rarely would we do that for unlaunching or a product obsolescence. It's just an inherent challenge, I think, with product obsolescence is getting the resource in terms of time, in terms of investment, in terms of manpower to really sit down and plan and come up with a strategy that's right for the business.
And my experience is companies do ignore the kind of end of life, and it does affect the bottom line. Because I think once you get into towards the end of its life and you approach commodities and the only way to compete on it because there's three or four other competitors doing the exact same thing is to drive your price down. And I think when companies kind of fail to realize that and they keep pouring dollars into the development of it. And at that point, you need to know that it's in that phase and you need to throttle back on the development, just put it into a low-cost maintenance mode so that you can get as many dollars out of it as you can with the limited downward cost pressure.
Yeah, Greg, absolutely. And I think the real challenge for a lot of us is timing, is working out when that time comes, when to start the rundown, the reduction, or the throttling back, as you very well described it. Doing it too early, doing it too late, and you really miss the opportunity. Getting that timing spot on as best as you can is really gearing you up for a smooth or well-planned, well-executed withdrawal.
And you also have the option, too, of sometimes you can do a pivot there. You can kind of let it go down and let it decay, or you can say, you know, we're going to pull this out of commodity and we're going to pour a bunch of money into it and add these features and functionality to make it kind of a product leader again. So there's always that decision point, and it's not an easy one to make.
No. And I think this is one of the big differences I see, or I certainly feel, between software and other lower tech or more physical industries, clearing our supply chain, for instance in the chemical industry, from start to finish. We have raw materials, we have intermediary stock, we have material in our own warehouses, in distributors' warehouses, right through to the end user. And to change can come for any number of reasons, anything from legislation, health and safety requirements on some of the raw materials that are used, through to a step change in technology. It only takes one competitor or one competing technology to come into the marketplace, and all of a sudden the old supply chain that you had in place that worked very well for any number of years suddenly becomes an expensive, time-consuming, painful excess that you need to address.
Right. It's not quite as easy as just turning it off in software.
No, there's no upload and no folders to delete. It's I'm conscious that it's certainly not that simple in the higher tech industries as well. Back onto the timing. There are a number of things that we need to look out for. There's some early indicators that give you a hint, give you an indication that it's time to start thinking about a future withdrawal or exit strategy. And I think the very simple one of those is looking at the customer and the customer's needs and the customer feedback. Are you starting to get calls frequently requesting additional features, other parts of functionality? Is there any indication that customer needs aren't fully being satisfied? Is there something missing? It may not be immediately clear what it is, but I think that's a real early warning sign that we can look for as product managers and try and jump on as quickly as we can to investigate further. Perhaps easier to spot is the internal indication that the revenue just isn't there. A product may have been a boom product some time ago. It may have been highly profitable, generating significant margin for the business. It may have progressed through to the stage of being a cash cow, which is can be a valuable part of the portfolio for any number of years. But at some point, that revenue will start to struggle, and you need to look at the cost of maintaining a product in the range compared to the revenue that it's generating for the business.
Excellent. John, I just want to interject that we have Jen out here on Twitter. She's at Roadmap Warrior, and she's joining us. She's a product manager from Kansas City and also a frequent participant. She comments that she likes the term product withdrawal, but it makes her think of something other than sunsetting. It makes her think of what product managers go through when they have to go on vacation. And she also says in answer to question one that you really need to know your product in order to sunset it properly. You need to know when to end accessory sales, base sales, support, and all of the other operations involved with it.
It's absolutely right. Absolutely. The early indicators that we're just starting to talk through now, some of those are very apparent, but a lot of them are very, very subtle, very difficult to see, quite easy to misinterpret and perhaps overreact to. And knowing the product range, knowing the customer base gives you the very best chance of correctly interpreting or correctly spotting and interpreting the early warning signs that are there, the very subtle flags that are being given, just a hint that it's time to start thinking about an exit. And this is a high risk stage. It really is, because the risk of going too early and executing a withdrawal ahead of schedule before it's really needed can be just as problematic as going too late and leaving things to fester for too long. So absolutely right. Knowing the product gives you the best chance of really spotting those indicators at the right time.
Yeah, I think it's important to have someone looking at the whole product portfolio, because it's one thing to have a single product and deciding whether to sustain it or let it drop, versus if you have a total of 10 products and then you have products that are in different phases of the life cycle. You've got some that are still in incubation and you're pouring money into the development of it. You got your cash cows, and then you got maybe some that are sunsetting. And when you've got a number of them going, it's a lot easier to kind of balance one against the other. You're putting money in and sinking money into a product to build it up, and then against some that are later on that are the cash cows, and you're getting your return on your investment from earlier money that you put into it.
Absolutely, and I think that's really where the process of ABC can kick in. The activity-based costing really strips away a lot of the other factors and looks at pure data and pure revenue. If you can sit down and you're able to calculate the cost of all of the activities that are required to support a product, you can really balance that against the revenue that that product's making for you, and that allows you to make a data-driven decision, or at least gives you a data-based input to then balance with all of the other factors, such as customer engagement and the options that are available. If something isn't working out on a financial level, but you don't have a sensible alternative or a readily available alternative to move to, I think that's a very uncomfortable position for any business to get into. The beauty or the theory would be that, that the sunsetting of one product links pretty seamlessly into the launch of a new one, very much the case with software. Doesn't always work out in the construction industry where I come from myself, but certainly something that we strive to do wherever possible.
Q2, what are the early indicators that a product is reaching the end of its life cycle specifically?
We've certainly tackled a couple of these already. The customer needs being addressed is a clear sign. When that stops to happen, you need to look. The sales force, any of us that have a direct sales force will immediately have access to certainly some direct feedback. A sales team, by nature, will look to the most profitable products or the easier sells. If something becomes hard to sell or doesn't generate the target margins that are expected of the business, that's a sign that you're either looking at a modification, an upgrade, or an incremental change. But it could also be a sign that the market has moved on, customer requirements are being satisfied elsewhere, or there's mass commoditization in that sector, which is just preventing you achieving the profitability that you'd like to see. In some cases, it could be more basic. It could be simply a change of business direction. The strategy or the vision of the organization may take a step change or a different direction, and a product that for any number of years has been a core part of the portfolio can very quickly become non-core, non-strategic, misaligned, and can almost be forced out of the product range just by not being a fit for the business today.
Yeah, and if you're listening to your customers, they will be telling you either in words or the fact that they're just not buying, and your revenue is down. I'll second what John was saying, and the fact that you suddenly have multiple competitors that have very similar products, and it's difficult to differentiate the product. Then it becomes a commodity, and it's time to start thinking about end of life.
Absolutely. There's additional factors, again, way out of our control. You have to listen to your customers. You have to know your products. But quite often, there can be some change in legislation, regulatory compliance, simple availability of raw materials in the manufacturing industry can force a product to be discontinued. And that's been a real challenge. The scarcity of raw materials for a lot of manufacturing industries across the globe in the recent 18 months, 2 years, has seen a lot of, I think the best term I can come up with is enforced innovation, where companies really have to quite rapidly find alternatives to existing products simply because the materials required to produce them are no longer available, either through simple discontinuation from the primary manufacturer, or some other legislative change making them either prohibitive or cost prohibitive to use.
Jen, Roadmap Warrior, says, another indication is that your product enhancement requests become product fee changes as opposed to mere updates, as well that third-party platform changes can also cause product obsolescence overnight.
Yeah, Jen, absolutely. The if you're getting feedback requests for enhancements that don't sound like the same product they're applying to, it really is time to take a look at the offering. An incremental change to an existing product compared to a fee change or a step change in the actual platform really does give you a strong indicator that it's time to upgrade with a new offering and discontinue what you've currently got.
Yeah, and sometimes that is an opportunity to create a very different product. Instead of getting your revenue based on a kind of an older line product, you can shoot for a better revenue with a more updated, distinct product. And you've got to listen to your customers. You can't just listen to those particular customers that are asking for the enhancements, but you've got to be talking to other customers and maybe looking at what other competitors are providing to see if there is a need for those enhancements. You don't want to have one customer specifically, a lot of times one large customer, kind of drive you off the cliff, and it's really not applicable to where the rest of the market is.
Sure. Yeah. Jen, I think Roadmap Warrior again has tweeted that third-party platform changes can indeed cause obsolescence overnight. And they're the ones that are the hardest to react to. I think purely from a timing point of view, there's a luxury in so many ways of having a timed, planned product exit strategy. Now, that goes out of the window if you overnight your marketplace changes and there's a rapid step change from a third-party platform. Yeah, you've got to move quickly.
I think that's a very good point, because as the product cycles get faster and faster, and there's new startups coming up every day to get a product up and going more and more, they're renting resources and building virtual teams and using other people's infrastructure, like Twitter or Facebook, and it's very good to get up and going fast with a minimal of cost and the maximum of features. But you are at the mercy of those that you are leveraging, the platform that you're leveraging. So you have to weigh the trade of getting up and going fast and cheap versus more stability in what you offer.
Yeah, certainly. And I think, again, leading on to one of the later questions, I think it may be the next question, some of the biggest challenges that we face. I think that is absolutely one of them, if not the biggest one. Perhaps the biggest challenge in so many ways is the personal buy-in that we all invest as product managers. Yeah, we put a lot of heart and soul and blood and sweat and tears into to launching these products, getting them from the idea stage through development, through requirements, through the testing, the beta plans, the field trials, the launch, pushing them up that steep curve through market penetration, to then turn around and take a lot of that work and say it's done, it's gone, we're moving on, can be quite a challenging thing to do from a personal level. If we've got a lot of personal buy-in, emotional buy-in to the products that we're responsible for, that can be a very tough process to be completely objective about. But that's the job. Yeah, product managers, we have to look at these things with an objective view to make the sensible decisions.
Well, so you're answering Q3, which is what is the biggest challenge facing a product manager during the obsolescence process? John, you're answering it from a personal level that we get invested in this product that we've shepherded throughout the whole process from birth, and it may be, you know, we've spent the past year or more, or we were hired to bring this product through. So does end of life for that product also mean end of our being valuable within this team? It's something that product managers have to be really looking forward and recognizing to make themselves relevant and to expand their product portfolio within the organization from the very beginning. I hadn't really thought about it in that term. In a startup as well, if they pivot so much that the current product that they're now bringing to market is so different from the previous product, then it is an issue of relevance, and it is an issue of being personally invested. But also, I think from a bigger organization, there's so much resources and operations, support operations involved in supporting that product, that it's difficult to move on from the status quo.
To add on to what you said, John and Cindy, I think it's more getting to the point where everyone agrees that you need to obsolete it rather than the actual obsolescence process, because there are, it's not just the product manager who's invested in it. Like you said, Cindy, it's many other people up and down the line. You know, you may have hundreds of people that are just dependent on that one product, and to make that decision, it has to be escalated up pretty high, usually into the organization, and you have to have the numbers. Hopefully, you've got numbers behind what you're trying to do to convince people of.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a relatively simple process for a product manager, certainly from my own experience, to go to the senior management to say that you want to bring a new product initiative online. It's going to require so many thousand dollars of investment. It's going to require a team of 3, 6, 8 individuals for a period of 3, 6 months. Whatever. It's much, much harder to secure that same commitment from the organization in terms of budget, investment, manpower, resource, when you're heading the other way, when there's no profit to be easily measured, and there's no product at the end of the process to secure the support needed for a product exit. Is much, much more challenging to demonstrate the value and to convince the team to come on board. And again, I think that's reflected in day-to-day business of new product launches, taking the share of the available resources in a company.
Great. Q4 is, how can a well-managed product withdrawal benefit the organization?
Okay. There's a load of different areas here, Cindy, but I really see two sides of the coin on this one. And I think for the one side, we don't have to look too far away. We can just talk to our colleagues over in the marketing department. Yeah, the marketing guys are spending their days searching, scouring the market for two real things. And one is customer engagement, and one is brand loyalty. And I think any marketing team that's got both of those in saturation are happy. Now, when you start looking at product withdrawal, product management really has got immediate access to those two things. You've got to assume that, I mean, it's almost by definition, a long-standing customer that's using your existing platform has already demonstrated a good degree of engagement. Unless you've done some pretty horrific things, there's going to be a degree of loyalty, or at the very least inertia, within that customer group. So, we've got access and access to potentially a highly engaged, highly valuable group of customers. And if the product withdrawal and subsequent replacement is handled and managed effectively, I think you can really benefit from the engagement that's already there. Thinking again for an analogy, I always think of Apollo 13 and the slingshot around the moon, where taking a product and it's at the end of its life, just about to disappear off into outer space, you can time, if you get the timing spot on with your exit strategy, to seamlessly tie into a new product launch, be it an upgrade or a totally different step change, you can really benefit from the existing inertia that you already have for that customer base. Now, the flip side, and I said there was two sides to this coin, you may decide that the customers that are using the product may not be the customers that you want to keep. So the other side of this story is that you've really created an opportunity for the business to look at what's potentially, well, again, if you're looking at withdrawal, it certainly is not a profitable revenue, certainly not the profitable revenue that it used to be. You may find you come across customers that aren't willing to change, that aren't happy with any other offering that's available. They may not want to switch from the current system to an upgrade. And you get into the realm of asking yourself, is this the product offering that you want to make? And is this the customer base that you want or need or can afford to retain? So you've got the opportunity there to really streamline the product offering and the customer base. I think there's a lot of tough questions there. And I think the reason they're sort of left kicked into the long grass in some ways is because they are tough questions. But I think the opportunity is there for product management if we're willing to take it.
Jen Roadmap Warrior says that in answer to Q4, backing up claims of expertise when you retire relevant trust is important, and vice versa. She gives an example of the BlackBerry.
That correctly, the reverse of understanding our product. Yeah, early on to push, to identify the timing, the exit strategy for any product, knowing your product applications is key. Vice versa, yeah, having the expertise to take away what we know is irrelevant and to keep the critical factors or the critical functionality, again, comes from really understanding your products and the customers that are using it.
I like the BlackBerry example because there are always customers who stick with legacy because it's stable and they don't have to educate new customers, and if they're using it internally, they don't have to teach everybody how to deal with the new features and functionality. But if you ride them too long, like BlackBerry did, and don't innovate, you know, they said, you know, our customers want that ability to have a tactile real keyboard, and we're going to stick with it. It will, you know, take them eventually down into obsolescence. So you need to know when to kind of let that go and maybe seed that part of the market to more lower end competitor and move on to the next best thing, which will carry you into the future.
Yep, absolutely.
Q5, how do you determine what services and support to provide for a discontinued product? I have a example of how this was handled badly from my experience years ago with NetObject Fusion, which at the time owned the space for web authoring software before Macromedia DreamWorks took over. They actually had built a huge customer space in Mac users and decided that they could no longer support cross-development of the Mac OS at the time, as well as the PC. And so they decided that they were just going to end the Mac product support when they came out with a new product launch, which I was charged with doing, there would be no Mac product. And even though they were a huge and passionate customer base, when I said, well, how can we support the customers going forward? They said, well, offer them a discount on the PC product. And needless to say, someone who was a passionate Mac user was not interested in the PC product, discount free, or even being paid to use it. It was a poor response, actually an indication of no support for the Mac users going forward. It was very difficult to cover up.
Well, yes. that's a great example, Cindy. I would not know where to start with covering that one up. It's a pretty blatant gesture. probably, I hate to say it, but probably not completely unique in that we could all come up with a couple of examples, I'm sure, of how how the exit strategy just hasn't worked. And like I said a few minutes ago, if you get it right, you've got a highly valuable group of customers that are already engaged, and you can just turn them into supercharged customers in terms of their loyalty for you and your company and your brand. If you get it wrong, wow, it's really, really tough to control and to manage the level of damage that can happen, and it can happen quickly. Yeah, a lot of the, particularly the SMEs, you know, the smaller organizations may well have constructed their business and their processes around your technology. And that change really has to be managed, carefully in terms of an exit. And it could happen over quite a period of time. The product may be discontinued long before the service and the support is. It's impossible to say what a realistic time scale would be for that to happen. But again, that's the challenge of working out how long you provide support for a product that's no longer available.
I think that the issue was that they didn't think strategically from the beginning. They didn't. It hadn't occurred to them that they might ever end that product for the Mac support. They weren't thinking ahead of how the market might change or what other competitors might enter the space. And so clearly that was a mistake. I really appreciate your suggesting that the end of life needs to be included in the strategy for the product from the very beginning. How do you know how the market's going to change? It may be 2 years out is too far ahead. I mean, the product was 5 years old at that time. But certainly every year, every update to the roadmap from a strategic level is important. The other thing that happened for me in that particular situation is I wasn't privy to what the strategy was from the VP of products. It became a tactical effort that I was told to handle this. And that was the beginning of my true product management education came out of frustration to things not being handled how I thought they should be.
Sure. What a great way to learn. There's any number of really great courses and study programs for product managers. But stuff going wrong in the field is a pretty powerful way to learn hands on, albeit not the most pleasant one.
Okay, so let's go on to Q6. We were talking about innovation last week with Jose Brioni, who has a very exciting take on how innovation is different from invention and how to deal with innovation at the different stages of the product life cycle. So today's Q6 is innovation plays a vital role in the early stages of new product development. But how can innovation also contribute to the later stages of the life cycle, specifically end of life?
Sure. And I'm watching Tweet Chat right now, Cindy, to see if anyone's going to come up with anything, because I don't have the big answers here. I'm looking to learn as much as I can from this episode, but. That's the challenge. I see that as the challenge, but I think we're obliged as product managers to force ourselves to think of it. Yeah, think of ways that innovation can support us this the later stages of the life cycle. Innovation, I agree. Yeah, we discussed it last week. Is significantly different to invention. You're not looking at creating something new from something that doesn't exist. You're looking at ways that you can use the tools and the knowledge and the experience that you have to tackle something in a better way, an improved approach, something that will add value to the activity that you're working on, and finding ways to do that for product withdrawal, and integrating innovation into that product withdrawal process is really, I see a massive, massive untapped opportunity for us if we can work out where to start. I'm thinking of reuse, for example. It doesn't feel innovative from a technology point of view, but I know large corporations are sending their old computer equipment out to developing countries and getting some some sustainable contribution through reusing the old technology. I know a couple of smaller software SMEs are trying to go to open source, so taking existing code or existing program and sending that out to be developed by their customer base once it's reached its end of its value chain within their own organization. There's a lot of things that can be done. Of course, innovation always carries varying levels of risk. Giving your products away to the open market, I can imagine, is a tough one for a lot of us to imagine. But there are things that I'm sure are out there, and I'd love to know what the answer was, or what some examples are.
I don't see the big challenge with doing innovation at later stages. I see it more convincing the organization to fund innovation after a product is up and going and a cash cow, because I think you tend to get complacent then. The money's rolling in. We're doing little tweaks on the product. We're maintaining, and we're kind of keeping up with what our clients want. The problem with that thinking is that someone's going to come along and just wipe you out. So my philosophy is you need innovation needs to be as strong in the middle, the latter stages, up until you decide that you're going to obsolesce it as you do getting that new product launched.
Yeah, sure. And again, that's much earlier on in the conversation we were talking about the pressure on product management to get a product launched, throw it out to the marketplace, and then quickly move on to the next big thing. Whereas spending some time and effort and resource looking at innovation in the middle of that curve, Greg, as you've described, really is the start of the opportunity. If we're able, and if we choose, and if we decide to take it.
Excellent. And we have quickly come up to the end of the hour. It's totally appropriate to leave us with an open question. I invite the community who is listening live and also in the future to blog about your take on any of these questions and your answers, as well as your personal experience in dealing with this, because one of our intentions here on the Global Product Management Talk is to open up these conversations that need to be happening across industry and to share, learn, and network about these issues as we would do in person at a product camp. So thank you again, John Newbery, for joining us today. Thank you, Greg, for being a great co-host. Thank you to our sponsor, the Association of International Product Marketing and Management. Please visit their website, aipmm.com, for the upcoming webinar on creating excellent products for your customers. I believe it is next Wednesday, August 15th. And join us next week here in the Global Product Management Talk, where Nick Muldoon of Atlassian will be joining us live from Agile 212, which is happening in Dallas, Texas. So we'll be talking about Agile and Kanban and software project management. And it will be interesting, John, how Agile is implemented in non-software corporations. That's always an ongoing debate of Agile versus Waterfall. So please join us next Monday, August 13th, and we'll be joined by our co-host in Australia from BrainMate. Look forward to that. Thanks again, and please visit our website, www.prodmgmtpalk, for upcoming events on and offline. Thank you, John and Greg.
Cindy, thank you.
It was a pleasure.
Have a great week.